Good afternoon. I'm Greg Daniel, Managing Director and Fellow at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at Brookings. We're going to go ahead and get started with our webinar today. Thank you for everyone for joining today. This is our continuing series of roundtable discussions on active medical product surveillance. We're pleased to be hosting today's webinar that will take a look at MiniSentinel Systems' new pilot program named the Prospective Routine Observational Monitoring Program Tools, or PROMPT. First, I'd like to just give you a little background to those of you who haven't been following MiniSentinel very closely. I'd like to give you a background on where we are today and how we got here. As many of you know, the Sentinel Initiative was established following the passage of the FDA Amendments Act of 2007, which mandated that the FDA develop a national electronic system for monitoring medical product safety. Congress directed FDA to establish a post-market risk identification and analysis system to link and analyze safety data from multiple sources. These data largely come from private sector health-related electronic data, such as health insurance claims data and clinical data. The Sentinel system is designed to improve FDA's capability to identify and evaluate safety issues in near real time. To also enhance FDA's ability to evaluate safety issues not easily evaluated within the current passive surveillance systems, and also to augment but not replace existing safety monitoring systems that FDA uses. FDA had set out a set of goals for the Sentinel program to accomplish, and those included at least 25 million to have access to data from at least 25 million patients by July of 2010 and at least 100 million patients by July of 2012. MiniSentinel has successfully surpassed those milestones and currently have maintained relationships with 18 data partners that cover more than 130 million individuals. The Sentinel system itself captures approximately 1.5 billion unique encounters in the healthcare system, within the healthcare system, and 3.7 billion dispensings. All of these data are extremely important, especially when rare safety outcomes are being evaluated. On the next slide, I have a slide that illustrates the distributed database. This pilot project utilizes electronic healthcare data, including administrative claims and clinical data, to conduct active surveillance. So how this happens is that there are 18 data partners, for example, the large health insurance plans, such as United through Optum, WellPoint through HealthCore, the Kaiser Foundation Research Institute, Humana, and others are included as data partners. These data partners format their claims and clinical data all in a similar fashion using a common data model, which is a set of formats that ensures that each data partner format their data in the same way. Having a common data model allows this distributed database to function. For example, as you can see in the diagram, a single MiniSentinel query can be written by the Data Coordinating Center at Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare and then submitted to each of the data partners. You can see the flames in this figure represent the firewalls that the data partners have. A unique aspect of the distributed database is that the data do not leave the data owner's firewalls, and that by formatting their data in the common data model, they can each execute those queries. Once those queries are executed, then summary results are sent back to the coordinating center for further analysis. MiniSentinel has become an effective and adoptable tool in the National Electronic Surveillance System for monitoring post-market utilization of medical products, occurrence of health outcomes, and potential safety risks, due in large part to the great collaborations that MiniSentinel has with its data partners and other academic institutes, as well as the tools and programs that they have to routinely and efficiently conduct analyses. On the third slide, I'll show a number of the programs that are actively used. MiniSentinel scientists have developed these programs to be able to conduct very rapid and appropriately designed programs. The modular programs are SAS programs that are designed to run against the MiniSentinel common data model. They're very rapid assessments of potential safety signals that are conducted in near real time by each data partner behind, again, their firewalls. Modular programs provide FDA with the ability to quickly evaluate potential risk identified, for example, through an FDA adverse event reporting system. So they can identify the risk through the adverse event reporting system and then quickly use some of these modular programs to get near real time data data back from the data partners. Protocol-based assessments, on the other hand, are more formal and detailed evaluations that are capable of greater sophistication in compounding control and in analyzing product outcome pairs. By leveraging customized study designs and protocols, these assessments allow for the measurement and comparison of exposure groups and outcomes while controlling for potential confounding factors and selection biases. However, these types of assessments do require significantly more time and resources than modular programs. As it enters its fifth year, MiniSentinel has begun to pilot a new program named the Prospective Routine Observational Monitoring Program Tools, or PROMPT again, which is the topic of today's webinar, with the goal of developing a relatively standardized, semi-automated routine prospective surveillance program that can examine a number of products simultaneously by monitoring the occurrence of health outcomes of interest in association with these newly approved medical products. This system is designed to identify potential excess risk for subsequent follow-up and will likely play an important role in FDA's ongoing safety surveillance efforts, as it can be used to follow a drug from approval through its use in the post-market space. Today, two of the Sentinel investigators, Jennifer Nelson with the MiniSentinel Methods Corps and Elizabeth Christchiles with the MiniSentinel Protocol Corps, will present an overview of the PROMPT system and provide more information on its objectives, design, and processes. Before we begin with Jennifer and Elizabeth's presentations, I'd like to just go over a few housekeeping items. We encourage all of you to submit questions throughout today's presentations. You can do that by submitting your questions online through the Q&A tab at the top of your screen as you think of them during the presentations. Once both of the presenters have presented, I'll call on you in the order that that you've submitted your questions, and I'll ask you to read your question out loud on the phone. In order to do that, you not only need to hit unmute on your phone, but you will need to dial *7 to unmute your line. Your phones are automatically muted, and you'll need to hit *7 to unmute. If you experience any technical difficulties, please call Level 3 Conferencing at 1-888-447-1119. So with that, I'd like to introduce today's presenters. Jennifer Nelson is a Group Health Research Institute and University of Washington, and Elizabeth Christchiles is at the University of Iowa Department of Epidemiology. After their presentations, again, we will open up the lines for questions. Please remember to use the Q&A tab, and please remember to press *7 to unmute your lines. So with that, I'd like to turn over the presentation to, I believe, Jennifer Nelson will be going first. Jennifer, are you on the line? And just, Jennifer, *7 to unmute your line.
Actually, Greg, this is Betsy. I'll be starting today.
Okay. And you unmuted, so that's great, too. Go ahead, Betsy.
Well, that's great. Thanks a lot, Greg. And yeah, Jen and I pulled a fast one, and I'll be leading off today with presenting an overview of FDA's MiniSentinel PROMPT surveillance system. And I guess I would start by just saying that I think PROMPT is quite a clever acronym, and it was first coined by my co-presenter, Jen Nelson, and so we have her to thank for this. So PROMPT is the realization of FDA's vision for a semi-automated surveillance system for new medical products as part of the full suite of surveillance tools that it has at its disposal. By adding code libraries, confounder adjustment, and several pre-programmed design and analysis modules for sequential monitoring to the existing MiniSentinel suite of modular programs, et cetera, that Greg has just recently described, the PROMPT system will be an incredible addition to the surveillance toolkit that FDA has with which to complete its work. This prospective routine observational monitoring program tool system will allow FDA to assess the occurrence of a fixed number of pre-specified health outcomes of interest that may occur in association with use of newly approved medical products. The surveillance will occur prospectively and sequentially as new products begin to be taken up by the healthcare system. PROPS joins several other mini-sentinel activities and FDA activities beyond mini-sentinel. Mini-sentinel activities, which can be applied to approximately 130 million patients covered in the health plans participating in the mini-sentinel distributed database, range from monitoring uptake of medical products to customized protocol-based assessments for products that have been on the market long enough for a single analysis to be powerful, as well as evaluations of the impact of FDA action, such as labeling changes, the impact of these labeling changes on patterns of use and so forth. FDA also conducts analysis of spontaneous reports arising from its AIRS systems and also from protocols on healthcare data outside of mini-sentinel. The PROPS system is ultimately expected to allow FDA to monitor dozens of products simultaneously. It employs a small number of surveillance methods that will be implemented through a library of method modules called PROMPs that can be customized to accommodate specific agents, outcomes, populations, and time periods for assessments. To achieve a goal of efficient prospective surveillance of many products simultaneously, procedures, standardized algorithms, and analysis methods and methodology guidances have been developed by a large group of individuals who have been working to prepare the PROPT system for launching. Here you see the steps in active surveillance of a newly marketed product, and we'll come back to this flow of steps a couple of times throughout the presentation. In PROMPT, the first step will be to identify the product or products to be monitored, and that will be done by FDA. So the planning begins once FDA identifies a product to be monitored. An important point to make here is that this does not necessarily mean there's an issue with the product, but that it is being looked at as part of the product's total pharmacovigilance plan. So these determinations to launch a surveillance plan are envisioned to happen approximately every quarter and to begin about 6 months before the desired start of surveillance. And at that time, a planning team is convened, consisting of FDA content experts, FDA safety evaluation experts, and other experts from FDA, as well as many Sentinel investigators, including at least initially one or more of us from the protocol core and representatives of the methods modules that might be selected for the plan. That would happen once the surveillance team selects a specific analysis module. The technical experts for those tools will also be assigned to support the team at that time. The Mini-Sentinel Operations Center will assign other individuals as needed to support the surveillance team. The planning activities that ensue, and those include developing answers to the questions that are listed here on this slide, and also preparing a written surveillance plan. The plan will document decisions that are made and the rationale for any decisions that required some deliberation. This written plan is envisioned to be fairly streamlined, organized around the key inputs that are required for the PROMPT modules. Importantly, planning will also include specifying follow-up activities for promptly evaluating any signals that should arise. So then the written surveillance plan that documents these decisions will include all the inputs needed to run the PROMPT analysis modules. Just a word about where PROMPT fits in the spectrum of surveillance. PROMPT was not designed for untargeted surveillance of health outcomes of interest, for which there is little or no reason or for concern regarding the product being monitored. PROMPT's emphasis is on identifying potential risks of a limited number of health outcomes of interest that have been selected because either one, that health outcome occurs in association with several other medical products of that type, such as acute liver injury for drugs or febrile seizures for vaccines, or another product in the class perhaps has been associated with that outcome, and so there is general interest in it, or perhaps there is reason to suspect that the product in particular might increase the risk of HOI, for example, because of a significant signal identified in pre-approval animal studies or maybe in clinical trials. The surveillance team will consider the suitability of health outcomes of interest for routine surveillance and may recommend additional or alternative health outcomes. Health outcomes will typically be defined from the mini-sentinel health outcome algorithms library or other sources such as prior mini-sentinel protocols. The library of standard algorithms for outcomes can be rapidly implemented, and in this slide you'll see just a smattering of the health outcomes that now have standardized algorithms specified in the library. Here's an example of an entry in the algorithm database that has been developed. So for each outcome, there's a primary recommended algorithm and often one or more secondary algorithms, which typically have been provided for use under certain circumstances, such as circumstances where either a more inclusive or more sensitive algorithm is desired, or perhaps they may include an ICD-9 code that appears promising but that has not seen much use yet in the literature. Some of the decisions the team needs to make are whether to exclude patients with a prior history of the event, whether to separate out cohorts for each product indication or for major risk factors and specifying high priority subgroups. For example, labeling changes to add indications may mean that product uptake for some indications may be slower than others, and risk factor distributions and confounding may vary with indication. In that case, separate cohorts might be advisable. The modules allow estimates for separate cohorts and also for high priority subgroups. Speaking of subgroups, for some exposure outcome pairs, there's an interest in examination within particularly vulnerable subgroups, and FDA has selected these cohorts as an initial priority for standard algorithm development for purposes of identifying vulnerable subgroups. Confounder adjustment is another important component of the prompt system. And there's another prompt tool includes a set of pre-coded core confounders. The list of potential confounders is large, and there is now extensive experience within mini-sentinel in specifying confounders for particular product outcome relationships. This experience effectively extends the library beyond what you see listed on this slide to include any variables previously used by a mini-sentinel activity. And the core library is really meant for routine consideration as pre-specified covariates in prompt activities, especially when the number of users and outcomes is low in the earliest monitoring period. Not all of the factors included on this list necessarily need to be adjusted for in every surveillance activity, and additional factors not on this list may be included in some activities. So moving on to the choice of the analysis approach, a variety of questions need to be answered in order to choose the analysis approach. And these include the type of observational design, cohort or self-controlled are the two we think of, the type and number of comparators to include, the eligible populations and subpopulations of interest, aspects of the statistical methods, including how confounder adjustment will occur and what measure of association is of interest. The methods taxonomy work group within mini-sentinel has developed two reports and an interactive tool to assist with weaving these decisions together to arrive at a recommended design and analysis approach. And the next couple of slides just show some of the categories of attributes that factor into determining the ultimate cohort design. It answers key questions such as, for example, in the first row of this table, there's a scenario in which a self-controlled design would be ideal, and the second row is a contrasting scenario where with exposure prevalence that's changing over time and where there's within-person confounding and a potential for onset misclassification that are of concern, and so the scales are tipped in favor of a cohort design. The decision on design and analytic methods is also affected by stakeholder preferences for relative versus different difference measures, the number of comparison groups, and the types of comparators. It's often the case that in addition to relative risk measures, it's of value to get insight into the attributable risk. Some of the modules can accommodate both of these. The taxonomy report that I was just alluding to led to an interactive tool that is centered on the characteristics that tip the choice in clear favor of one design and analysis versus another. And I've given a little bit of an outline about that tool here. At this point, what I'd like to do is to turn the controls over to Jen Nelson, who's going to talk more about the design and analysis modules themselves. Jen?
This is Jen. Can everyone hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great. Okay, so thanks, Betsy, for that introductory.
Hey, Jennifer, actually, it would help if you speak up a lot, because now all of a sudden it's very soft.
Okay. Is this better?
Yeah, that's a little bit better, so keep doing at least that much.
Okay, sure.
All right, thank you.
Yep. So now that you've heard about the initial steps that prompt involves in terms of defining outcomes, exposures, and confounders, and choosing an analytic approach, I'm going to give you an overview and some additional details about the modules themselves, and in particular cover the remaining steps, estimating risk, assessing whether that risk is concerning or not, and the reporting of results. So to start with a brief overview, the main goal is to have a modular program approach to drug safety monitoring that can be implemented in a distributed database system. And so what we've done, and this is really in year one, we've built pre-programmed modules that we can quickly activate to monitor and the use and safety effects of new and existing drugs. And so the key steps in this approach involve the construction of an analytic data set based on pre-specified inputs, many of which Betsy has described in terms of population eligibility, outcome, exposure, and confounder definitions. Secondly, then, we can use the modular programs to describe the population of exposed and comparators, estimate safety effects across the data partners. And a key aspect of all of these steps is that we can run these modules one time to do a single analysis, or we can conduct them repeatedly over time as data at the contributing data partners are refreshed, and in particular as uptake of a new product occurs using sequential testing methods. And if we're doing this repeated monitoring version of implementation, we have some additional pre-specified inputs that are required in terms of specifying an overall false positive rate that we're interested in controlling across tests, plans regarding how often to test and how high or low to set the signaling threshold over time, as well as sample size requirements. So in terms of a little more detail, the modules involve validated programming code, and so this code has been developed and tested by the developers, as well as tested QC testing and beta testing by the Mini Sentinel Operations Center, so it's been sent out to sites to ensure that it's working in the way that we expect. It can be run at any or all sites on whatever schedule is desired in terms of the monitoring plan that is pre-specified in advance. One key aspect is that the methods, they're not new methods per se. I'm going to talk about this in more detail in a minute, but they involve standard epidemiologic designs as well as statistical methods. And I think the key new things about this have to do with the fact that we're implementing them potentially over time as uptake occurs, and we're doing it in a way that preserves data privacy at the data partners. But basically, we're just conducting epidemiologic assessments and doing multivariable confounding adjustments in one of four different ways: a self-controlled design, propensity score matching, regression, or inverse weighting. And I'll be getting into more detail on each of those in a moment. The methods, as Betsy described, can estimate difference measures, ratio measures, and they're specifically designed to address potential heterogeneity across data partners. In addition, they allow flexible employment of a variety of the different sequential designs and analysis in terms of the sequential monitoring plan and the signaling rules that you might specify. So just to give you an operational update or information about where these programs currently stand, so we've had a year of development, and version one of the code is available and has been tested, as I mentioned, within the distributed data system. This code was developed using several example drug outcome pairs where the association was deemed to be known. So I list those a couple true positive associations and a true negative association upon which this code was developed. We've also developed initial versions of users' manuals that describe the module inputs that are required and the standardized output that's produced, and also information that describes epidemiologic and design and the statistical methods that each module employs. In addition, there's the first version of the surveillance reports that can be generated using each of these methods. And so in this next year, there'll be a lot of integration across these different methods, as well as further testing and enhancement of all those pieces, the code, the manuals, and the reports. So here's how this fits into the flow diagram that Betsy presented earlier. So once we've chosen an analytic approach, we have four different methods that we can choose from to estimate the risk, apply alerting rules, and report results. And so I think the key point I want to make here is that we have purposefully developed multiple tools so that we can have a diverse set of methods to employ, because we don't expect to always be pointed, we don't expect one method to be preferred in all instances. So the first module is based on a self-controlled design, and so this, it's a variant of the self-controlled case series method, and so it utilizes only the cases, those who have an observed event, and it compares risk in exposed and comparator time windows within the same person. So a couple of advantages of an approach like this is that it requires minimal information on each person, because time-fixed confounders are implicitly controlled when you're making comparisons with this, within the same person. Future versions of this module will allow for adjustment for time-varying confounders. And then one additional point to mention relates to the type of sequential testing that can be conducted. The testing is based on a likelihood ratio test statistic, which inherently is comparing the observed number of events in the exposed window to an expected number of events that we estimate. The boundaries extend an existing sequential method that has been used within the vaccine safety data link for a number of years, the maximized sequential probability ratio testing method. And so the boundary employs a flat boundary over time, so the same signaling threshold at each look, but involves some flexibility in terms of how we can employ the testing. You can delay the first analysis in particular until you have enough information, and then conduct continuous testing if you'd like thereafter. And so here's an example report. This is based on one of the example pairs that the code was developed on that gives you an idea of the type of information that you might see when reporting the surveillance results to the FDA and to investigators conducting surveillance. So we have information about the new events that occurred in the time since you looked last, information about the cumulative number of events, and then estimates of the risk difference or the relative risk between the exposed windows and unexposed windows. And then the final sets of columns have to do with hypothesis testing results and whether or not we reject the null and conclude that there is a positive signal at that particular look. The second approach is the first of three cohort approaches. So, for example, a new user design. And the reason we've developed three approaches to implement in the cohort design setting is because we do expect that the cohort approach to be one that is used quite a bit with new products that are coming onto the market. And so this method involves individual-level data that remain at each data partner, and at each site, and with data that remain at the site, a propensity score is estimated, either based on pre-specified confounders or using a high-dimensional propensity score. Then individuals within site are matched, exposed to unexposed patients, and we can evaluate diagnostics based on information at the site. Once we've developed a matched cohort, then minimal data are then combined for central analysis at the operations center. And with this information, we can compute hazard ratio estimates, relative risks, risk differences that compare those exposed and not exposed or comparators, and that those statistics are can be done in such a way that it's stratified by data partner. Future versions of this module will also allow for disease risk score matching in addition to propensity score matching. And in terms of the sequential framework that underlies this method, if you're implementing this method at multiple points in time as new uptake of a product is occurring, the sequential testing is very much like what I described for prompt one, sequential testing based on a likelihood ratio test statistic and using sequential boundaries that are formulated in a similar manner as prompt one. So just to step back and give you an idea of how flexible and sophisticated, for example, the data creation capabilities are for some of these modules. So for the propensity score matching module, you can see you can provide inputs that will give you substantial flexibility in defining exposures, outcomes, exposure windows, washout periods. You can use enrollment data to reconcile overlaps and gaps, and so on. And on the next slide, you can see the beginnings. This is an excerpt from the user's manual that describes some of the data extraction inputs. So when you go to create an analytic data set based on this method, you provide an array of inputs, and the beginning of that list is described here. And so just to visualize what I described in words on a previous slide, so you specify these input parameters, and that initiates the start prompt 2. That code goes out to the site, creates an analytic data set, propensity scores are computed, diagnostics are run, summary information comes back then to the operations center where we then can compute aggregated statistics, so stratified estimates and conduct testing. And when we get to the bottom at the end of a monitoring period, we can then restart and move back to the beginning once we have new data available for analysis. So here's just an example of the type of diagnostic report that can be generated to assess whether or not at any given assessment, at any given look, you have balance before and after matching. So were you successful? Should we go ahead and estimate the risk using the information that we have? And here's an example of what the results might look like over time. So here we see estimates of a rate difference over time in the figure at the top, and then underneath we see a lot of underlying information that supports and is under the hood sort of as underneath that rate difference estimate. So the third prompt tool is a regression module. It's the second of three cohort data approaches. Much like the matching approach that I just described, individual data remain at each data partner, and de-identified information are then combined for central analysis. So in this approach, instead of matching to control for confounding, regression adjustment is performed. And the method is the regression module has a lot of flexibility in what type of regression model you can fit. If you're interested in an odds ratio, you can use logistic regression. If you want to estimate a relative risk, you can use Poisson regression and incorporate person time information, and so on. It also has sequential testing capabilities. They're slightly different, but similar in many ways to the sequential framework that's available for prompt 1 and 2. This approach leveraged the existing randomized clinical trial group sequential method literature and allows us to have flexible boundary-shaped specification, so we can have early conservatism if we would like in our signaling, or we can conduct testing that has the threshold at the same level or flat over time. You can also customize the testing plan. One difference from randomized clinical trial methods with regard to the sequential aspects is that it uses an exact method boundary formulation as opposed to using large sample normal approximations. And that's important because we're dealing in a setting with rare events. So here's an example of individual level data that may be at each data partner. We have for down the rows for each subject, we have very specific covariate information in terms of age, gender, smoking status, weight, height, vaccination status per se. That type of information remains at the data partners. This is the type of information combined grouped data sets that could be sent then to the operation center. So these are minimal information, simply a number of event counts and number of people or person time stratified by categories of exposure and categories of confounders that may be of interest. And this is the information that the regression models would be fit to, for example. So the final prompt module is a third cohort approach method. So we've covered matching. We have regression capabilities. We also can conduct inverse probability of treatment weighting, weighted regression. And so this approach, again, like the other methods, the individual level data remain at the data partner. Similar to the matching method, this approach involves computation of a propensity score, in this case based on pre-specified confounders. And then also at each site, a linear regression model is fit. So a weighted linear regression model weighted based on that propensity score to estimate a risk difference. Then the summary statistics, specifically the site-specific risk difference and information about its variability, are the only elements that are combined across data partners for analyses. And so this method, like the matching approach, acknowledges site heterogeneity by computing a stratified estimate. The sequential framework, the final two bullets, are very similar to what I described for the third prompt module. The sequential monitoring methods extend randomized group sequential trial methodology, but account for rare events by conducting exact testing methods. So just to visualize what I just described, so we're computing a stratified inverse probability of treatment-weighted risk difference. So at each site, we get a site-specific propensity score that we estimate using all the detailed confounder information available at each site using logistic regression. Then at each site, we calculate a site-specific risk difference and get its variance. And those two pieces of information along with sample size are sent to the central location where we compute a stratified estimate across all sites. There is one additional layer of complexity, as I mentioned, because we are dealing with large samples, but when you boil down to an exposed group for a new medical product and a rare event, you're back to relatively small samples. And so to accommodate that and to not rely on large sample theory, we use exact methodologies to, in particular, a non-parametric permutation approach to compute the variance. And so in addition to the risk difference and its variance, and sample size, we also get a permuted data set that tells us about the distribution, expected distribution of the test statistic under the null. And that's the distribution by which signal testing is done. So in terms of the semi-automated example reports that one could generate using this particular module, here's one example of a standard table one. Many of the other modules also produce this type of descriptive table to tell you how your exposure and comparator groups compare across demographics or other risk, clinical and risk factors. This is the measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella vaccine, separate injections of MMR and V compared to the combination vaccine. This is one of our example pairs. Here's an example of an uptake figure. So it shows in each group how fast we're accumulating information about number of exposed over time. And then this might be the save page of final surveillance results. So down the rows, we have look 1, 2, 3, and 4 performed at specific date, number of days into the surveillance period. And then across the columns, we see information similar to the prompt 1 self-controlled report that I showed. This shows number of people and number and percent of outcomes in each of the exposure groups, as well as the estimated risk in each group and the risk difference. And then the final columns talk about the test statistic and boundary and whether or not a signal is observed based on the observed information. So that gives you, I hope, a better understanding of what these four different methods can do and what's involved. A question that may be on your mind is what happens when we find a signal? What happens when we see something based on any of these modules that might be implemented? Those of you who have conducted surveillance like this before know that the answer to this question can be a whole talk in and of itself, so I'm only going to cover just some examples of post-monitoring follow activities that we might be conducted. And I should also say that these analyses will also potentially be conducted in the absence of a signal. These types of activities include checking the data, checking the code, conducting subgroup analyses, potentially adjusting for a broader array of additional confounders, testing against other comparators, and varying other types of definitions that we use at the outset in terms of outcome and exposure definitions. And potentially, if we find that the administrative information doesn't give us enough of an answer to the question, we may then conduct medical chart validation of cases potentially. So there's a variety of activities that would naturally follow. So here's a couple example reports that we can already produce in a semi-automated way. This is for the inverse probability of treatment-weighted nudge method prompt 4 that shows some of this additional data that you could potentially look at to better understand what you're seeing when you're combining and testing across all sites. So here's demographic information over time. And here's an example report that would show site-specific analyses. So you can see if there's one site that's in particular driving the results. or if there are just you can observe the heterogeneity that may exist, and that would give you some information about robustness of the overall finding. And so that brings us a full circle, really. So these, in the discussion of each of these four methods, you can see risks are estimated, results are aggregated, and alerting rules are applied over time, with the final step being at each look and as a signal potentially is observed, results that get reported to the FDA, and potentially to the public when appropriate. And so I'll just leave you with one concluding remark regarding that, and that is that the information from this particular surveillance program, from PROMP, is not standalone. It's intended to be used to complement other FDA activities and data to help inform regulatory decision-making and potential action. And so thank you very much. That's all I have.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jennifer. And I'd like to thank both Jennifer and Betsy for two great presentations. As I mentioned to all of you, please submit your questions via the Q&A tab, and then I'll call on you. We do have a question from a Mark. And Mark, I'll get to you in 1 second. I do have one question for both you, either Jennifer or Betsy. I'm not sure who would answer this one. And then after that question, I'll go to Mark. Didn't leave a last name, but it's Mark that I'll call on. So my question to either Jennifer or Betsy, whoever decides to take it, is a lot of detail around the particular PROMPT programs that will be included in terms of the flexibility around the study design and other related analytic techniques. But my question is more on the front end on do you envision that the majority of many Sentinel queries will be, I guess, in the future being using more of these prompt type queries versus the traditional modular or protocol based or not? I guess my question is more, how often do you think that prompt will be used?
I can take a start at that. And Jen, why don't you chime in? Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah. I think that prompt has some particular unique advantages, and it's particularly well suited for new products as the uptake evolves over time. Whereas the protocol-based assessments, for example, the one-time protocol-based assessments are most conducive to, potentially follow-up of findings from PROMPT or elsewhere because of the ability to customize those and so forth, but also for situations where there's already enough use of the product so that a one-time look is sufficient. So that would be one contrast. So I think they serve different purposes. And then the modular programs, I think have been a wonderful platform on which the methods modules have been able to be based, and they do draw from those modular programs in terms of getting preliminary information that's needed to construct the inputs to the methods modules. But that's my general sense, that these are really very different pieces, and it's always hard to predict the future, but I think they have very complementary uses. Jen, if you want to forecast something?
No, I agree with what you said. I think, at least for me, these are the modular programs which can provide minimally adjusted estimates, the prompt tools, which are designed to provide not fully adjusted, but additional confounder adjustment beyond what the existing modular programs are capable of, and then a customized protocol, which would be the deepest dive. So these are just different tools that allow you to get a different level of insight into the information on a particular drug outcome pair. And so I think it remains to be seen exactly how these might be used in concert or which instance one might be preferred over another. The idea, over time we expect these prompt tools to evolve and improve and be able to incorporate more sophistication, both with the type of data that can be pulled, the amount of confounder adjustment we can do. And so we would expect these prompt tools to hopefully be approaching what you might be able to do with a customized protocol-based assessment over time. So that would be a goal that I have for these particular modular programs.
Okay, great. Thanks. That's very helpful. So I will turn it over to Mark, who has a question, and just to give the others an idea of the queue to get ready. After Mark, we'll go to Helen Edelberg, then Raj, then Thomas Welch, and then Fred Schneeweiss. So, Mark, if you're on the line, please press star 7 to unmute and read us your question. Thank you. Okay, this, Mark, you didn't give your last name, so I'll go ahead and read the question to both Betsy. You're on. Okay, go ahead and read your question.
Oh, okay. It's actually Mark Levinson from FDA. And I have a very simple question. The inverse propensity score weights are there. That method gives you something stratified by the sites, if I understood correctly. Is that true for the other three methods as well?
So for the propensity score matching approach, you can also compute a stratified estimate. So the inverse probability weighting approach, I suppose you could describe as being most close to a meta-analytic approach, although it uses more than simply the risk difference in its variability. It uses more of the underlying information at each of the sites, but that's one way of thinking about it. The other two approaches you can conduct, you could conduct subgroup analyses by site, but the overall estimates are not explicitly stratified by site.
Okay, so you said the matching, you have the option to stratify by site or not?
Correct.
Okay, well, that's my question. Thank you.
Okay, great. The next question is from Helen Edelberg. I'm not sure if Jennifer Elizabeth will be able to answer. This is more of a question to the FDA, I think. But Helen, if you're on the line, can you go ahead and read your question?
Certainly. Can you hear me?
Sure, yes.
Oh, great. So this probably is a question for the FDA as much as it is for the presenters. Certainly, this is a wonderful adjunct to the other tools we have at our disposal for assessing the safety of products. And we'd like to know at which point in this evaluation would the marketing authorization holder be notified of the findings?
This is Betsy, and I do think that is an FDA question, and they're discussing this amongst themselves now. So I don't know if there's anyone who wants to speak from FDA that's on the call.
Yeah, it is a good question. This is Greg. I would say, you know, in the technique that was presented here, probably, you know, I would assume that the role of the FDA and the usual process that they have for engaging the manufacturers when there is a safety concern that comes up wouldn't change here. That this is just one additional tool that would be used within the Sentinel system. But not necessarily change any of the other roles and responsibilities. But if there is anyone from the FDA that would like to comment on that, let me know. If not, we'll move on. So the next question comes in from Thomas Welch. Thomas, if you're on, star 7 to unmute. Okay, I'll go ahead and read Thomas's question. It reads, are there similar approaches being implemented elsewhere internationally? Elizabeth or Jennifer, are you aware of any other approaches or international that might be using something like this?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I don't either.
Okay, and then we have a question from Fred Schneeweiss.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
I thought the presentation was excellent. I'd like to know if the code used for MaxSPRT is available.
That's a good question. So currently, I think plans are to post the information regarding the user's manual as the description of methods can be available. I don't know that we've had discussion about how the code might be, the posting of the code or sharing of the code. So that's a good question that we should talk about more within our group.
Okay. And the next question is coming in from Jinghua Hu. Jinghua, if you're on the line and you can press star 7, please read your question.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I just wonder if there's any empirical data regarding the positive, false positive or negative findings with this tool.
So, John, I don't know if you if you've looked at this at least in related activities or in some of the true positive, false negative test cases.
So the question relates to false positives and false negatives. I didn't catch the specific question around that.
Okay. So suppose we have a positive finding, well, with a relative risk of 2, then how confident we are this is a true signal or not?
Sure. And that's a complicated question, but certainly the slide that I showed that talks about what do we do if we see a signal or what do we do if we see any particular estimated relative risk or risk difference, there are obviously a lot of follow-up analyses that one would want to do just like you would do in a non-sequential epidemiologic assessment because there's certainly the potential for bias to be entering in, and we would want to conduct follow-up analyses so that we could better understand the initial result that we got, how it might change as we change things like the outcome definition, the exposure definition, who's included in the cohort. So we would really want to do a good job understanding the information, both understanding the information that goes into these analyses as well as understanding how the analyses and the choices that we made in conducting the analyses might affect that result. So I guess that's a short answer to a difficult and complicated question.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you. So those are all the questions that we have had. I know a number of folks have asked for additional information on Mini Sentinel as well as the presentation for today's webinar, and Mini Sentinel information can be attained from the minisentinel.org website. Also, Brookings does post past Brookings events that were related to Mini Sentinel on our website, and also today's presentation materials, including the audio, will be posted over the next few days. I would like to thank Jennifer and Betsy for their terrific presentations, and I'd also like to thank everyone who tuned in for today's webinar. In addition, we're planning a few more webinars in the coming months. We'll be sending out an announcement about it in the near future, and we look forward to your participation in future events. Thanks again for participating, and have a great afternoon.